You are listening to Community Radio, WRFG, Atlanta, 89.3 FM, your station for progressive information.
Opinions expressed on WRFG do not necessarily represent the opinions of Radio Free Georgia Broadcasting Foundation, Inc., its staff or volunteers. You are listening to WRFG 89.3 FM, your station for progressive information. And you are listening to Alternative Perspectives, the weekly program about the GLBTQI community, produced by Betty Kupitier. Alternative Perspectives is about the gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender, queer questioning, and intersex community, informing about the issues that affect us and our allies, and the common humanity that connects us all. This is Alternative Perspectives, and my name is Betty. And in the house, we have Becky is here, and we have Bridie Mae Johnson with us, who is one of our newcomers. And joined the team recently, and we welcome both to the studio. Donna is on her way back from Tallahassee. She was down there at a special conference for the ovarian center, the Ovarian Cancer Society that she works for and volunteers for. At about 7:15, the Reverend Irene Monroe will be calling us, and I'm looking forward to an exciting conversation. And we're going to give you the news from This Way Out, and then when we come back, we should be ready for that interview, which has been arranged by Becky for us this week. Are you ready, Becky?
I'm ready. Let's
do it, huh?
Let's do it.
Let's get the news first, and then we're going to be chatting up a storm, and we'll give out the number to call, and I'll give it now, and then I'll give it again later, 404-523-8989. If you want to call, you want to join the conversation, you have a question to ask, we have some guests calling in also other than the Reverend that will join the conversation with us, and we'll announce those. And Nancy, of course, will be calling from Sacramento, another member of the team. Okay, but we have others calling in, and they will be joining the conversation. It's going to be an exciting conversation. I just know that. Okay, so for right now, the news.
The time that it takes to change these laws does mean that people are discussing the issue. And we're also discovering who the enemy are. And they were the people who were behind Proposition 8. And they were connected with the church.
Hard with an edge like matzah and cheese. There's no running away because I'm locking the key.
Don't keep the ghosts inside. Get them out of your head.
I need you to tell me things you know I need.
Welcome to This Way Out, the International Gay and Lesbian Radio Magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Is Uganda bowing to worldwide will? A night and gay appraisal of Proposition 8 and Wizardry, Twins, and Songs of the South in the audiophile. All that and more this week because you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Rick Watts.
And I'm Tanya Kane Perry.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending January 23rd, 2010. The government of Uganda appears to be feeling the heat of international condemnation over its proposed Kill the Gays legislation, despite several statements by its leaders to the contrary. In addition to the death penalty for certain cases of consensual adult gay sex, the measure imposes a life sentence in the African nation for others convicted of that crime. It also punishes, with lengthy jail terms, anyone who promotes gay rights or who fails to report a suspected gay person to the authorities. Its sponsor, MP David Bahati, adamantly asserted earlier this month that he would never accept changes to the bill. But he reversed himself this week. Bahati told Uganda's Daily Monitor newspaper that he might accept amendments to the bill without putting the values of the country at risk. Bahati attended a meeting with the cabinet on the bill this week, but said he could not discuss what happened. Information Minister Kabakumba Masiko told the newspaper that because it is a private member's bill and a property of parliament, the process of legislation must continue. But the government will suggest amendments. Uganda's President Yoweri Museveni has already suggested that the harshest elements of the bill should be discarded, but it's believed he was only referring to the death penalty provision. Visits by U.S. evangelicals and so-called change therapists have been blamed for inflaming the homophobia that already permeates Ugandan society. Bahati and Museveni have each been described as affiliates of The Family, the secretive right-wing self-described Christian group based in Washington, D.C., with global political ties. It sponsors an annual national prayer breakfast in the U.S. Capitol. Both Bahati and Museveni had been invited to attend the event on February 4th, but according to reports this week, Bahati's invitation has been withdrawn. It's not clear at this time if Museveni will attend.
Following the U.S. Martin Luther King Jr. Day holiday, the federal trial challenging the constitutionality of California's Proposition 8, known as Perry v. Schwarzenegger, moved into its second week on January 19th in a San Francisco courtroom. High-profile attorneys Theodore Olson and David Boies are representing the plaintiffs, a gay couple and a lesbian couple who were denied marriage licenses in the state. Jerry Sanders, the Republican mayor of San Diego, was first to take the witness stand on day six. He had previously supported civil unions only. But in 2008, Sanders came out for full marriage equality during an emotional speech in support of his lesbian daughter. His testimony was again emotional at times this week as he said, "My daughter deserves the same opportunity to be married in front of friends, family, and co-workers." The former police chief cited examples of hate crimes against LGBT people and of police officers afraid to acknowledge their sexual orientation. "If government tolerates discrimination against anyone," he said, "it is very easy for citizens to do the same thing." Brian Rahm, the senior lawyer for the Alliance Defense Fund, which is defending Proposition 8, asked Sanders during his cross-examination if it wasn't possible to oppose marriage equality but not be motivated by animus towards gay people, which is one of the plaintiff arguments. Sanders said that good faith beliefs don't change the fact that they are positions grounded in prejudice. Testimony by an economics professor then centered on how civil unions don't adequately serve same-gender couples as an alternative to civil marriage. Citing a dubious study in the Netherlands, the defense asserted that opening marriage to gay and lesbian couples could have a negative effect on heterosexual marriage.
A 26-year-old victim of so-called change therapy testified the next day, and other evidence was introduced to demonstrate that sexual orientation is immutable. Expert witnesses for the plaintiffs then testified that, despite some incremental gains, lesbians and gay men don't have sufficient power to protect themselves in the American political system. Defense attorneys claimed during cross-examination that they do. Evidence was also introduced linking the Mormon and Roman Catholic churches to the campaign supporting Proposition 8, furthering plaintiff arguments that the measure was motivated by anti-gay prejudice.
A supporter of Proposition 8, whose name appeared alongside ballot arguments for the measure, testified for the plaintiffs as a hostile witness on the trial's eighth day. Footage from a deposition by Hawk Shing William Tam, played during the first week of the trial, corroborated letters he had sent during the campaign to Chinese American churches claiming that opening civil marriage to same-gender couples would lead to legalizing having sex with children. He also wrote that other states would fall into Satan's hands if gays and lesbians weren't prevented from marrying in California. Tam had unsuccessfully tried to withdraw as a named defendant in the case. He testified that he believes that gays are 12 times more likely to be pedophiles, and that allowing same-gender couples to wed would lead to the lowering of the age of consent, enabling adults to have sex with young teenagers. He cited different literature I have read, but when pressed, said he couldn't remember the specific sources of those claims. He also tried to downplay his role in the Prop 8 campaign. Testimony by the 55-year-old immigrant from Hong Kong, who heads a Northern California-based group called the Traditional Family Coalition, was used by the plaintiffs to prove that Proposition 8's success was rooted in homophobia.
On January 21st, the trial's ninth day, expert testimony bolstered plaintiff claims that sexual orientation is unchangeable, to again support the argument that gays and lesbians deserve the same judicial protections as racial and ethnic minorities. The defense is expected to begin its arguments and present its witnesses in the coming week. Chief U.S. Judge Vaughn Walker, who's presiding over the non-jury trial, said he would delay closing arguments for 2 weeks after the defense rests its case so he can have time to review the testimony.
Another U.S. district judge this week denied the petition of ProtectMarriage.com, the sponsors of Proposition 8, for a restraining order against the Courage campaign for using a parody of the Pro-Prop 8 campaign's logo in its online trial tracker federal court case coverage. The original logo featured figures of a man and a woman and two small children. The Courage campaign logo depicts two women and two small children, which ProtectMarriage.com claimed was substantially indistinguishable from theirs and therefore constituted copyright infringement. Judge Lawrence K. Carlton wrote that, "Plaintiff is unlikely to overcome the conclusion that defendant's use of the mark is protected under the First Amendment, in that use is relevant to an expressive parody, and the use is not explicitly misleading."
Proposition 8 was also cited in a seemingly unrelated decision by the U.S. Supreme Court this week. In a 5-4 ruling, the High Court overturned limits on corporate spending in political campaigns. First Amendment rights were ostensibly at issue, and reaction to the court's decision was split even among free speech advocates. More than one progressive commentator warned that the Supreme Court had put democracy up for sale to the highest bidder. But in support of the majority decision, Justice Clarence Thomas cited arguments over the release of the names of those who donated to the campaign in support of Proposition 8. He wrote that such disclosure would chill protected speech because it would provide political opponents with the information needed to intimidate and retaliate against their foes.
Meanwhile, in an 18-7 vote, the Hawaii State Senate approved a bill on January 22nd to create civil unions for gay and lesbian couples. It would grant all of the state's marriage rights, except the name, to both same-gender couples and heterosexual couples who choose not to marry. Democrats also control the House, but party leaders said they may not bring up the bill unless they have enough support for a 2/3 vote to override a possible veto by Republican Governor Linda Lingle.
Elsewhere, Brazil's President Lula da Silva is facing strong opposition from the country's Roman Catholic Church over his government's national program on human rights, which would include the legalization of abortion and the expansion of rights for same-gender couples. According to an online report by Merco Press, which covers news from Latin America, the Brazilian Confederation of Bishops has vocally criticized the proposals, which include enacting same-gender civil marriage and granting adoption rights to lesbian and gay couples. Da Silva sent his human rights initiatives to Congress in late December. The bishops' opposition to the proposals was discussed at length during Sunday services in all of the country's Catholic churches in mid-January. Brazil's presidential election is scheduled for October. According to local political analysts, Da Silva launched the human rights initiatives to remind voters of his party's credentials as the main opponent to the former Brazilian military dictatorship.
And finally, under pressure from Portugal's Roman Catholic Church, the Lisbon City Council has withdrawn its invitation to same-gender couples to participate in its Santo Antonio weddings, which promote marriages in the capital by providing struggling couples with complete financial support for an official wedding. The online Portugal News reported that a council press release had originally announced that there were 5 available places for interested same-gender couples. The country's recently passed same-gender civil partnership law is expected to come into full force well before the Santo Antonio weddings, which will take place in June. But the council issued a statement this week that there will be no alterations to the current model of Santo Antonio weddings without the consent of the church. It is necessary to respect the religious beliefs associated to Santo Antonio, a saint of the Catholic Church and Roman Apostolic.
That's News Wrap for the week ending January 23rd, 2010. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap is written by Greg Gordon and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles. You can read the text of this week's News Wrap online at www.thiswayout.org.
Okay, and we're back, and we're going to have a word from WRFG, and then we're going to go straight into our interview with the Reverend Irene Monroe. We'll be right back.
Sac passé.
Mabule.
WRFG wishes to express our heartfelt sorrow for the loss and pain caused by the 7.0 Richter scale earthquake that hit Haiti on January 12th that has left millions adversely affected. In response to this great tragedy, WRFG is working with the Haitian Alliance to help provide relief for the victims in Haiti. WRFG is a collection location for the earthquake relief drive. We are collecting these necessary relief items: water purification tablets, medical supplies, for example, first aid kits, antibiotics, etc. Meals ready to eat, non-perishable items, tents, cots, pillows, sheets and blankets, toiletries, body bags. WRFG is not collecting financial donations. More information on financial donations and updates on the relief efforts are on the Haitian Alliance website, transformhaiti.org. WRFG is an official collection location for the Haiti earthquake. Please bring donated items listed above to WRFG Radio Monday through Friday, 11 a.m. until 6 p.m. at 1083 Austin Avenue, Atlanta, Georgia, 30307. For more information, you may also call 404-523-3471 or go to WRFG.org. Let's do our part.
Okay, we're back, and we welcome to WRFG, an alternative perspective, the Reverend Irene Monroe. Hello, and how are you this evening?
I'm quite happy this evening for two reasons. One, to have the wonderful opportunity to be on your show. But just moments ago, about 10 minutes ago, my partner walked in the house. She was deployed to Haiti with the organization Doctors Without Borders. And I've been nervous while she's been away, and so it was wonderful to see her walk through the door. And
wonderful.
The few minutes that we were just playing catch-up, just telling me what it was like just to be down there, and I'm very proud of her to be down there and all that have gone down there to help the folks in Haiti.
That is wonderful. Maybe if she has a moment, she would like to talk to us in a minute after
we get. Absolutely. Can you just hold on? I would. You know what? It would just really be wonderful because she literally just walked in the door.
That would be just so wonderful.
Can you hold on just one sec?
Sure. Sure.
Okay. They would like to talk with you. Hold on. Here she is.
I'm going to take a moment to read just a short bio on the Reverend Irene Monroe. She's a graduate of Wesley College and Union Theological Seminary at the Columbia University, as well as the Ford Fellow at Harvard Divinity School. Serves on the African American Roundtable for the Center for Lesbian and Gay Studies in Religion and Ministry at the Pacific School of Religion, sits on the advisory board to several national LGBTQ organizations. In 2009, MSNBC named her 10 Black Women You Should Know, and we know her, okay, because she is here, okay? She has been profiled in The O, Oprah's magazine, on CNN, and the Gay Pride episode of In the Life TV, a segment on her that was nominated for an Emmy, and she has featured and was featured in the acclaimed film For the Bible Tells Me So. And I just have to throw this in, okay, because we have something in common. We have two things in common, Reverend, okay? We both hail from Brooklyn.
There you go.
All right.
It's always in the house.
And people look very closely on that For the Bible Tells Me So at the credits, at the very, very end, mm-hmm. they'll see my name on there.
All right.
You know why? Because I held the mic while the producer of the show was doing his filming. Okay. I'm very proud of that.
Glad that's, you held that mic.
Right, that's my piece of theater in Hollywood and whatever else they, you know, you throw in there when you do something like that and your name is at the credits of some film. And the Reverend Irene Monroe, a syndicated queer religion columnist with editorials that appear in 43 states across the country and in the UK. And it goes on and on and on and on and on. But I am going to stop right there because we have the Reverend Irene Monroe on WRFG 89.3, your station for progressive information, okay? And we're gonna talk to her partner who just came back from Haiti. And this is awesome. This is like
a double,
and this is like a scoop.
It's a double,
okay?
It really, really is, and stuff. She's a tad tired, but I
okay.
I
just a minute or two.
Her.
Yeah, that'll be great. Just a minute or two. Just let us know what it was like down there. She was there with the doctors.
Okay, so listen, I'm going to let you talk with her for a second. It's Dr. Thea James here. She's a ear physician at Boston Medical. Said I'm just absolutely proud of her. She's in an article titled U.S. Clinic Opens in Haiti to Deluge of Injured, and it's a picture of her. This was published January 19th. This is on NPR's web, so you can get a picture of her and stuff.
Yes,
but,
yes.
Thea's been doing disaster medical emergency ER medicine for a good number of years. This is not the first time that she's been deployed. She's been BAM Iran in 2003. She was in Katrina. Mm-hmm. She's been to just 9/11, just a number of just disaster areas. This is her passion. So I'll let her talk with you momentarily.
Here. Okay. Okay.
Good evening.
Good evening. Good evening. How are you? I know you're tired. I thank you so much for giving us a few minutes of your time. But we won't keep you long, okay, so you can get your rest. But tell us why you were down there, what you did, what you saw.
Well, I'm a member of the Disaster Medical Assistance Team that's under the National Disaster Medical System, which is a federalized team. Mm-hmm. Medical response team, and we got deployed pretty much immediately after the earthquake.
Really?
I guess, you know, just devastation and sadness and sorrow and just people really resilient and making a way out of no way. Many people on the team were quite surprised at various different times that the way some of the things that people were able to endure and the way that they hold on and things that don't really happen in medicine happen there. Mm. So among the Haitian people. So we basically saw many orthopedic problems, many broken bones, some people with infections from wounds that had been festering for so long and they were unable to get medical care for quite some time. And lots of little babies who came in from illnesses that probably began as profound dehydration and then just evolved and progressed to other things like infection and that type of thing and respiratory problems. Even some psychological problems we saw that were mainly in young teens and the sort of psychological problems where they become nonverbal, they stare off into space, they're sort of incontinent of urine and stool, don't walk anymore. I mean, it's quite an astonishing sort of phenomenon. It was interesting to see that. At least right now, there wasn't very much in terms of infrastructure to address those sort of psychological problems that we saw. But it was never ending, and I don't know. We didn't sleep very much or mm-hmm. very much or...
Are you going back?
I don't know. It was just quite an experience. Mm-hmm. It was quite an experience. Mm-hmm. And it was like Katrina a thousandfold. And then we all, experienced aftershocks constantly. Wow. I don't know if you heard about the one that was 6.1 Monday.
Yes, we did hear. Yeah, we heard another one yesterday, 4 point something or something. Yeah,
absolutely. Even now, yeah. I was taking a shower and I felt like the tub was moving.
Oh, wow.
It's interesting. I mean, I don't know what that is.
Wow.
But
and you were able to come home.
I felt very privileged to be able to go there, to have the privilege to go, mm-hmm. and to be a part of, a relief effort that allowed me to be able to go down there and to help as much as we possibly could.
Okay. What is your full name? Because I didn't catch it before.
My name is Thea James. Thea is my first name. Uh-huh. Last name James.
James. Thea James. Dr. Thea James. Okay, your specialty is?
Emergency medicine.
Emergency medicine.
I work at Boston Medical Center here in Boston.
Okay. And is it so, it's pretty much what we've been hearing on the media here about the lack of antibiotics, medication, trying to fix bones, tourniquets made out of belts and so forth and so on.
Oh, yeah. But, you know, it was interesting to me, you know, I keep talking about the resilience of the Haitian people, but sometimes they would bring a person in with a bleeding injury or something, and they knew to have a tourniquet above the injury. I'm sorry, below the injury. Mm. They sort of knew so that this thing would not
bleed out
or something like that.
Wow.
Or above it. I'm sorry. I'm so tired. I forget.
Yeah.
using this. But anyway, they knew to do this type thing. Our hospital, our team is a self-contained medical unit. Mm-hmm. And so we actually take our hospital with us. We were an operating room and an ICU, an intensive care unit, as well as some urgent care type setup. So,
were you at the airport or were you in the city itself?
We were in the city.
Wow.
We were right next to one of the tent cities, as a matter of fact.
Oh, my. And you got
and
there just
they
right
call them
after.
Because wow. They're not tents, they're tarps.
Tarps, yeah, that's what it looked like
these
to
people
me.
Have really just
they kept calling them tents, and I'm saying that's
sticks.
A tarp that they tied to trees or whatever, you know.
Exactly. They're not really tents, they're tarps.
Yeah.
And wow. So we also took our pharmacy with us. So we had plenty of medications and antibiotics.
Oh, that's good.
To
that's
people
good.
With.
Okay, good. That's one of the things that they were saying, that they didn't have enough medication or enough antibiotics, and that it was causing, issues and problems. People getting infections and not
that's right.
Able
and you
to
know,
treat
we
those
did,
and people could die.
I mean, there are amputations. Mm. That we did, and we have lots of little kids that are too young to speak,
wow.
and in some cases too young to walk, mm-hmm. and no one knows who their parents are or where their parents are. Even if we even had one of those kids who had an amputation.
Mm-hmm.
These kids were found sort of just crawling around in the street.
Oh,
and some of the team members really fell in love with some of these kids, and
I'm sure
I was telling them I was
we fall in love with them. We're just watching on television,
every 20 minutes someone had one of the kids. Everybody was coming to carry the kid around every day. I was, and they would give the kid a name. They would just name the kid themselves, and everybody would come looking for the kid so that they could keep him for a while and that type thing.
Yeah, wow. I want to thank you, Doctor, for taking the time on your return here, just as you returned, and giving us time to talk to us and give us
thank you. I'm honored to be able to speak with you. Thank you so much.
The honor is mine. Thank you. Get some rest now, okay?
All right, I will.
All right. Okay, Dr. Irene Monroe.
Hey there. I'm so glad that Thea gave you a brief sort of synopsis of what it was.
That's
she has a great name, because Thea means goddess.
Okay.
So it was just wonderful. It's part of our recording. I said to her when I met her, I said, "Do you know what your name means?" And she says, no, what does it mean? I says, it means goddess. And so I said, well, you know, you're my black goddess here.
All righty
so.
Now. I just, we have another caller on the line. First, we have Nancy is there from Sacramento. She's part of our team. And she is our arts and entertainment director. And she clues us into a lot of stuff that's going on out there. She is a straight ally and gives us information on GLBT folks out there being creative. And also we have, surprise, surprise, Bridie, Michelle Brown from Detroit, Michigan is on the line.
Oh, Michelle. Hi.
Hey.
Bridie just came from Michigan. She worked a whole lot up there with Michelle as activists and did some wonderful, wonderful things. She is now a member of this team down here because, as I tell folks, I grabbed her as she was crossing the border, okay?
Right,
before anybody else grabbed her, because she came with a lot of talents and professionalism and know-how, et cetera, et cetera. It's what we need here on Alternative Perspective. So I just grabbed hold of her because she was a friend of Michelle's, and I knew. Yeah, I just knew. Yeah.
I'm blushing. Welcome. Thank you.
Welcome, Michelle. Hi, hi. Is it cold up there?
Hi, how
is it cold
are
in
you
Michigan?
All?
Irene, the Reverend Irene Monroe is up in Boston, so I know it's cold in Boston. It's cold in Detroit.
Oh, indeed it is.
Well, I'll tell you, Reverend Irene, you get around. Last time I saw you was in the White House. Now, you know.
That's right. That's exactly right.
That's exactly right.
So when I heard that you were on the call, it's like, I just saw you about a month ago.
Yeah. Yeah, I read the article, and I said, oh, wait, it'd be nice if I called Michelle. Then Bridie was here, and I said, well, let me surprise Bridie, because she told me she hadn't talked to, this was last week. I know she talked to you today, but she told me she hadn't spoken to you, so she got here. So I said, well, let me ask Michelle. She'll call in on Tuesday, you know, and surprise her. I said, Michelle, don't tell her, okay?
And she didn't tell.
And she didn't tell, no. That's great. And yes, I read the article that you wrote, Reverend Monroe, on the Washington, the White House visit with the National Black Justice Coalition.
Yeah, it was just a wonderful experience, wouldn't you say?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, I thought so. It was just a really nice experience to be there, you know, especially since most of the evening they were recognizing the LGBT community and seeing people who I knew from HRC when I was on that board, and here we were as the National Black Justice Coalition. I was just like,
all right,
all right.
All right. Yeah, the chest was out there, huh? That sounds great.
I was very honored. I thought what was really important, because a lot of times when we talk about LGBT, inviting the LGBT community, too often communities of color are excluded. And I was sorry that we didn't see a large contingent of, you know, Latinos and Asians. And I'm hoping that if the invitation comes around next year, that it'll be even many more faces. But what I took away from that trip, you know, which is what I wrote my article about, was that a lot of times when we talk particularly about slavery, we look at it mostly through a heterosexual lens and not understanding a couple of things, that not all the slave masters were straight, not all the slaves were straight, but equally important is that as black LGBT folks, we're tied to that history in Washington, D.C., that if our ancestors were part of building that house or building that city, we're very much connected to that movement, to that moment in history. And so it was kind of wonderful to sort of walk through that house, to know that Sylvia Rue, who is the religious advisor for the National Black Justice Coalition, mm-hmm. her great-grandmother, great-great-grandmother was, you know, born in the Blair House, and to know that Reverend Deborah Johnson, who was also among us on that tour, you know, is related to George Washington's wife, and that her great-great uncle was the first black postmaster general. So it's just a wonderful kind of history that sort of gets eclipsed when we just look at it through a heterosexual lens.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and I think that the other thing that, I mean, there are intersections of homophobia, racism, classism, xenophobia. But I think that one of the things that it's important that we were there and to acknowledge these things, because the black LGBT struggle didn't just happen. I mean, it didn't come up at the same time as Stonewall. That we are part of a huger, larger struggle a part of the infrastructure of this country. I mean, we have been there at the beginning, and it's and it was good to me also that here we were walking in here, you know, where for years we never came through the front door, but here we were coming in, and we were talking about what's current, what's real, but we were also representing the past, the struggles of, you know, what has happened with racism, how far we've come and how far we haven't come.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that was just, I was just very pleased with it.
That's great. That's great. And that the necessity for it to be kept at the forefront, to be to, the stories to be told, you know, to be written about, it's so important. It's so very important. It's
you know, and I'm hoping, too, that in the future, I agree with you, I mean, that is that there will be more people of color. And, I mean, I have to give credit where credit's due. I think that, in part, one of the things that, that helped make that happen was our executive director.
That's right.
Being that forceful and assertive and getting it, you know, and that's what, you know, I don't even think of her as a straight ally. I think of her as my sister. But it's
right.
Like that
I think
thing
of her as our sister friend.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and, you know, and that's how, and that's what's really important is, like, that there is that connection and that she gets the struggle and the link. And that's what needed to be done because often we get overlooked. I mean, I know that, you know, we'll have one or two people who show up, but most of the time the people who are speaking for communities of color are noticeably absent. When they talk about a gay issue, that you usually see mostly a white gay man. Mm-hmm. And that also keeps the problem that we are dealing with internalized homophobia is because we're not out there. We should be out there saying it and be representing for our community. So mm-hmm. I'm hoping that it's a continued experience each year and that each year you'll see more and more communities of color so that we'll say that rainbow isn't just, you know, our flag, it's our community. We're that diverse.
Okay.
That's beautiful.
And we better
sort of avail ourselves to Obama's invitation that this is indeed the people's house because I don't know if he'll get a second term, and if he doesn't, I don't think the doors of the house will be open to us again.
Again, yeah. we better put our foot in there and leave it in there, okay?
Absolutely.
And not let them throw it out, you know what I mean? Yeah, but I know that Becky has some questions for you regarding some of the other subjects that are going on in the GLBT, the issues that are going on in the GLBT community. Becky?
Reverend Irene. It's Becky Jane.
All right.
Hey, how are you doing? It's been a long time.
It certainly has. My God, Steph, how is your artwork?
Oh, I'm artist in residence at Virginia Highland Church.
And where you should be. I'm so delighted to hear this.
Well, thank you.
This is good news.
And you know our pastor, Chris Glosser.
That's right.
Yes. It's a wonderful church. But so I'm artist in residence there. Let's stay on you, because we are honored to have you here.
Absolutely.
Proposition 8. Where do you see that trial going? Have you been following the trial? I remember reading one of your essays where when the proposition first passed, there were some quarters of the LGBT community and also beyond in the progressive community that laid the blame on African Americans.
Right,
and
right.
I remember you writing that essay. It was so poignant. Would you please elaborate on that and the damage it has caused?
Okay, I'll say a couple of things here. First of all, what happened in something like Proposition 8, when you have, you know, the white gay community blaming African Americans for, you know, its outcome, there are a couple of things. It's clearly not understanding the interconnections of oppression and also how to reach out to certain groups of people. So, for instance, when I heard the news that that African Americans were being blamed for Proposition 8, the first thing I wanted to know was, when did the state of California become a black state?
Exactly. Exactly.
Because what I understood was that that African Americans throughout the state of California only make up 8%. So that was problematic in and of itself.
The other problem here too, and so you there's a couple of things. One is that I really felt that that the folks in California thought of their strategy in a way that really was not about reaching out to African Americans. I think that California, feels like they had enough money, they got a lot of star power, and that's pretty much all they needed. And not understand that your best link, if you want African Americans, black ministers in their churches to support your effort, is that you have to make links, first of all, with black LGBT people. And the community, the larger community as a whole, has always been very tentative, if non-existing, in terms of making those necessary links first with us. They don't bring us to the decision table. But then how this played out terribly, and I call it divide and conquer, because to be quite honest, it's about our government. Why would any government put as a ballot question a person's right, civil right, as a ballot question? And it's an egregious act, of the law, and it's a travesty of justice, simply because if the issue of slavery had to be a ballot question, it's no telling where we might be today.
Amen.
If it was left up to the populace to decide on my freedom.
Amen. You're right about that, Reverend Irene. It's always been an act of social injustice to make civil rights a referendum.
It's just an egregious act. It's just, so then what you have is divide and conquer. You have us fighting among ourselves. Mm-hmm. Now, this is not to say that homophobia does not exist in the black community. Of course it does. Of course it does. But one of the things that it failed to ignore was the money that the Mormon Church had poured in,
absolutely,
into Proposition 8. And one thing that they forgot to look at is that blacks voted like Catholics voted, like Mormons voted, because for the most part, when you talk about the black church, it's fundy, it's conservative. So they voted like other religious conservatives did. So it was very unfair to say that, the bill didn't turn out the way that the gay community wanted it to because of African Americans. We got to look at African Americans in a much larger lens other than just race. Okay, I mean, we're conservative. Most of us are Democrats. Most of us live in urban settings. I mean, it's a very narrow way in which the white queer community, sort of cast us.
Mm. Absolutely.
Reverend Irene Monroe, my question, I'm very, basic kind of simplistic thinking, I guess, I don't know, but I always get to that point of saying, why do we allow ourselves to be divided in such a way? I mean, if we acknowledge certain things and we have certain information, why is it that, it happens? And why is it that those in power know is going to happen?
I think it depends on, when I think about this, I think a lot of it has to do with who's at the table making the decision. Mm. And one of the things that we have not carefully, and I think it's very, very hard to sort of not only critique, but to sort of dismantle, is what I really call a white, gay male hegemony in our that dominates a lot of the most important issues in our community. Because we really need to tell the truth and shame the devil, that there's tremendous sexism in our community. Mm-hmm. Misogyny in our community.
But isn't it a mirror of our larger community?
Yes, of our larger community. Mm-hmm. So we're fractionated in many ways. We're fractured along gender lines, mm-hmm. along class lines, and of course along race and ethnicity lines, and even gender identity. I mean, think about it. Think about how transgendered folks are discriminated by the larger LGBT community. When Enda didn't get, the whole thing with Enda, and you're leaving out transgendered people. Mm-hmm. I mean, and that decision was agreed upon, our
sort of decision makers in our community, like, well, this is the way we have to go. Okay, we can take gays and lesbians, but we can't take trans right now. Mm-hmm. We come back and get you. I mean, that's crazy.
Yeah, it is crazy. It's throwing them under the bus.
Yeah, but even, you know, that I didn't understand, you know, because at the time,
right, because I think it is because that's a very kind of linear model. But if it was a communal model, and I mean, when you think about women, you know, you're not going to leave one child. You're going to bring them all. Okay.
Right, right.
I mean, when you hear about, you know, when you hear about the narratives around slavery or even mothers crossing the border from Mexico coming into the United States, they bring all their children. It's like we move together, and however that is. And I just feel that as long as we have a very white, gay, male, privileged model, mm-hmm. we will never reach whatever that promised land is for us. Mm-hmm. You know, we will never reach it.
Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I guess one of the things that I observed, and I'd like to hear your opinion on it, one of the things that was like a aha moment for me, but all, not just really for me, but like when I turned around and said to the community, is like, why is it? Because here, there's a lot of furor over a picture which showed an African-American minister marrying a white couple, and there were two African-American men, both of whom had on sunglasses. And there was a lot of talk about it, and there were even some things written in where they talked about, oh, and here he has two black goons for his protection, and they brought in all of this, you know, and they looked at, and here's the black church again against gays. But, you know, no one took a step back and said, isn't it interesting that the haters were able to unify and come across race to put this front? And I'm sure that they knew what that picture would get this reaction from some people, and our community bought it, not just stepped back and said, you know what, why aren't we together where we can
right.
cross race lines, cross, you know, our gun for our cause for equality.
Right.
And I know people who went out there and worked, and they said that that's what they saw, these big white organizations, and they didn't go in the black community. And, you know, Star Power, you know, didn't do it for us.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm curious, it's like, you know, it's like, it seems like they're getting a message and able to manipulate us, and we keep going for it.
Right.
And
yeah.
When are we going to get smart?
When are we going to learn? Yeah, when are we going to mm-hmm. see that they, you know, I mean, I could go on and on and on and talk about my experiences on in that arena of being used to draw in people of color, you know, to certain organizations. And, and it's just for their whatever, you know, they want numbers and they want this, and it's for their own agenda. They're not really, you know. And
it's more symbolic.
Yeah, it's more symbolic or whatever it is, because I don't even call it that. It's just that they are knowingly doing what they're doing, and knowing what they're going to do after if they get or don't get the results that they're looking for, because it's been a planned out plan.
That's
and then
right.
they'll switch up to do something else if that doesn't work, and leave us who have been working to the bone, you know, alone, you know. And it's okay, we've used you to the hilt now, and we don't need you no more. We're going to go on, okay? And it's just, they do the same thing that, you know, the bigger, you know, the bigger picture does, you know. So it's like,
right.
when are we going to learn? That's what I want to know, because we seem to always just keep falling right back into the frying pan, you know.
I think we have to choose who our community leaders are,
mm-hmm.
because a lot of our community leaders play the same game as the dominant culture does,
mm-hmm.
and it's about power by any means necessary,
mm-hmm.
and so then you have your rank and file like us, who are operating out of a moral consciousness and compass,
mm-hmm.
in terms of how to move forward,
mm-hmm.
but they're just about, I don't care how we move forward, I don't care how we do it. And so that tends to be a problem. It's that we need to think about the people who shapes the kind of national and even communal discourse around, you know, social justice for us,
mm-hmm.
and unfortunately, a lot of times the people who do get chosen tend to be people who have power and privilege and have money. Not too different from the kind of, it's sort of like you got to pay to play. Not too different from our, you know, American politics.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, that's the it's I know that it's, you know, controversial in some arenas, I guess, but it's something that needs to have some conversation. You know, we fell into it in all arenas. I mean, it's, you know, everybody believed that change could happen in 2008, and we got sucked in. And now we're in a place where, okay, so now what's going to happen? Because it looks like, you know, the GLBT community is going to be left hanging, okay, after a whole lot of promises.
Look, you know, I was a big critic of Obama's during his campaign, because I really knew that was rhetorical sort of BS there on a whole lot of level. But the point is that we didn't hold him to the fire enough. Right. We seem to, like, be sort of just agog if he winked and nod or mentioned LGBT in you know, in one of his speeches, so that it came when June of last year came, you know, where we wanted to celebrate, well, most of us celebrated the 40th anniversary of Stonewall. We had to look and say, well, you know, here's a president who really used our political clout,
right,
you know, to help win his presidency, and we're left hanging. And the point is that I always think that we buy into, with every president that, you know, that says that they're in our camp for us, is like, we always like, not now. We got to do the budget. We got to do this. We got to do that. But it's always about us. We must wait.
We must wait.
When?
And for how long? Right.
And so the point about it is that we sort of fall into this notion of hope that our chance will come, but we don't have a good strategy to make sure that chance does come.
Yeah, but then those organizations that are supposed to be fighting for us to get us those chances tell us that we have to wait, and it's incremental.
right, and that's what I'm saying, we got to make a better decision about who comes that makes these decisions locally as well as nationally for the LGBT community. That's my point.
Yep.
We have to make that decision.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, you know,
okay,
what?
That we don't have someone that sells us down the river, or someone that compromises with the devil, or someone who really doesn't care what happens to us, but does a very good show, and we buy into the rhetorical discourse.
Right.
You know, that we're part of this, you know, big tent movement, when in essence we're really not.
Right. I mean,
think that the other thing that always amazes me is, like, we go through that, and yes, we did. We got him elected. We pulled through. We did that. But then we always seem so happy to be. Okay, we seem to be so happy with a pat on the head. You know, we get all gaga when we hear someone. I mean, and yes, it is nice to finally have a president who can say, you know, LGBT. But we like that's like oh wow, and that somehow because he does all this, we are beholden, and we just go along, and then, okay, well, we can wait, but, you know, he is mentioning us, where, to me, I got him elected, okay? I'm calling it in, and we're not there, and then we're not in the fight. We're just really happy to be with it. The health care fight, you didn't see much of the LGBT community there. Well, guess what? We're supposed to be there on every part, and we're supposed to show up and demand, you know, those answers to the promises, but we're not showing up. We're just waiting for another little pat on our head and going like, you know, he mentioned us in his speech, or did you see he came to a dinner? You know, we have to demand.
That's right.
More of it. I mean,
that's right.
Not
we have
because he let us down on Don't Ask, Don't Tell, and that to me that was a no-brainer, and that could have been a very easy decision.
Right. He let us down on, you know, there's a whole bunch of stuff. I mean, even with the ender.
And
it's all held up because it's like it's they're tweaking. What was it that we said here?
Tweaking the language.
Tweaking the language. Okay. I mean, it's pretty simple to me. Just put it so that everybody is protected. Okay. What is with the language?
Tweaking the language means it's a way of selling us out. Okay?
Yeah, yeah. I know that. Yeah. But you know, what do they think we are? And then we get our leaders that supposedly that have been at the table talking about getting to this point. Oh, we just have to wait a little longer. You know, it may happen by 2012.
But you know what, something, though? But do you notice that the leaders that do not really represent or look like the community? That when we look at many of these organizations other than sort of NBJC, and National Black Justice Coalition is not really up in the same tier with HRC or the task force,
right,
you know, various other organizations that we have here and stuff. But when you look at it, you know, again, you see, you know, straight, and I thought, well, I don't mean straight. You see white, you know, gay, privileged males running these organizations.
Right. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so the, it can't who are, be. It,
who are,
I mean,
who are lawyers.
In and of itself.
Who are lawyers, and they're embedded in the corporate world, and they mm-hmm. have the privilege of all of that that we scorn at. In the regular mm-hmm. society, we say, well, that has to stop because we'll never get, you know, to be a just society if we continue having this separation with the privileged on one side and the rest of us on the other side, you know.
Right.
But we emulate that in our own organizations.
That's right.
You know, and until we stop doing that and we put people in place that are going to speak for us and it is by us, okay?
Right.
I mean, literally by us. Yeah, you know, and that it's not going to change, folks. It's just not going to change.
How do we break it? How do we break this out of this?
We need more people involved. We need more people to understand the seriousness of it all. That we have to get people to understand that it's not going to get better just by simply being a good boy and a good girl and saying, oh, okay, we're going to just wait until they're ready to give us whatever they decide we deserve. Okay.
Yeah, I think you know, the question is how do we move forward, or how do we get better at this?
Mm-hmm.
And I feel that the only way that we can begin to get better at this is really to hold our really local and national organizations accountable mm-hmm. to our particular needs. See, I don't think that we have learned to exercise our rights,
our power,
that's right,
mm-hmm.
of what we want on locally from these organizations and nationally.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that when they go to the bargaining table, if they do for us, they don't go with representing us fully.
Right.
Because they have not been in dialogue with us. And we have
right.
to make them.
Yeah,
we
right.
have to really make them be in dialogue. But see, my point is that if we have a leader in our local community that we don't like, I'm just saying this hypothetically, we have a voice to say, this person is not a good person for us, and just state why. It's not
exactly.
that I hate you, it's just that given the specificities mm-hmm. of what we need in this community,
mm-hmm.
this is not going to work. I'll give you an example. So if I'm in a, you know, in a black queer community, okay, listen, a white, you know, gay privileged boy, you know, from San Francisco ain't going to work for me. You know, it's like he's not going to be able to speak to our needs.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But we need folks that understand how to speak for what we want. And
right.
I don't think that we exercise that power and right ourselves.
Yeah, and we need to go back to, you know, the subject that was mentioned earlier in the conversation, is that we need to learn how to cross those color lines, okay? We need to understand one thing, okay, that if we're GLBT community, that regardless of whether you're black, white, Hispanic, Asian, you know, Catholic, Protestant, Presbyterian, whatever it is, okay, that what we have in common is that we are a community of GLBTQ folks. And we need to fight together, okay? We need to make that the focus, not the fact that if we're white or black or, you know, Catholic or Protestant or whatever, you know, because
That's
we
right.
let we let those things divide us.
Mm.
And the opposition knows that those things divide us, so they use it. They use it. They're so well organized, okay? And they have a plan. They have a plan, and they read it, and they may, at home, they may not agree with each other when they have their little private meetings and stuff, okay? But when they come out in public, they're thinking with one mind, okay? And they know what they're going to do, all right? And that is to divide the other folks. The other folks, in this case, is us, okay?
Well, you know, and I'm going to, and this is my hats off to you, Betty, but mm-hmm. what we need more of is what you do. We need mediums where we can educate, empower, and strategize
mm-hmm.
at a grassroots level.
Mm-hmm.
Because, and one of the good things about it, this economic downturn is, in the past, everyone followed basically a business model, which was really based on white men doing what they're going to do,
mm-hmm.
where now you have younger people who are throwing out the book. They're doing things differently.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what? We can do that. But we need to talk about it and strategize and then empower ourselves to go in and be at those rooms, make ourselves be invited or even slip in uninvited and do it. But then the other thing is, like, a lot of what's happening in our community, we don't know about. We don't know about from city to city. And I think that when you see the failure of the LGBT press, there isn't no city has a major person to cover LGBT issues.
Right.
You have people there who don't know what the fight is about.
Right.
Don't know what it is.
Right.
And so that's. It keeps us ignorant.
Ignorant, you know, yeah. Ignorant, and we have to go on. Yeah,
it.
Folks,
so
we have
to educate, empower, and then come up with a strategy.
Right. Michelle, we're running out of time. We have 8 seconds. I have to end this program. I thank you, Reverend Irene Monroe, and I hope that you will return and speak with us again. Okay?
I would love to. And I thank all you sisters for the work you do and
okay.
keep it going.
Thank you, Nancy, for being in on the conversation out there in Sacramento. Okay. Nancy, you still there?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, thank you, thank you. We don't have any time. We have to go. We're over time right now. Thank you, Michelle. Thank you, Reverend. Thank you, Nancy. Thank you, Becky. Thank you, Bridie. And good night and buenas noches.
Good night.